Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only. Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Welcome to the 337th episode of the 4th and 24 podcast with Patrick Winograd. I am your host today, Patrick Winograd. In this edition, our topics are a review of my weekend predictions, a look at the NFL playoffs, our weekly look at the NBA, a recap of the past week in college basketball, and a quick look at the end of the Australian Open. We're going to talk about the quarterfinals and then what might happen going forward. But let's jump right in with a look back at my weekend predictions. Starting in the NFL, where I went a perfect 2-0 again, which means that I've gotten every pick right through the Super Bowl, which would be really sad if I got the Super Bowl wrong, but we won't get to that preview just yet. We'll do that next week. I picked the Seahawks. I picked the Patriots this weekend. We'll see who I pick next week. In college basketball, I went 2-2. Texans beat number 21 Georgia 87-67. That was kind of a slam dunk prediction. Georgia kind of struggles away from home. Especially this season when they're playing an evenly matched team, and Texas pretty much as good as Georgia, according to those metrics that tend to predict games with high accuracy. So that one a pretty easy pick for me, even though, you know, technically number 21 losing to an unranked team shouldn't be that easy, but it was pretty easy in my head. Then you have Illinois, who beat Purdue 88-82. I'm not saying this just to say this. I really thought about picking Illinois to win this game. I thought that out of all the teams this weekend, if there was going to be a road team to win, it would be Illinois. And I actually had picked them. And then when Purdue lost to UCLA, I changed my mind because I thought there's no way that Purdue loses two in a row, knowing how big of an opponent they have coming in and coming off a loss. They don't lose in Mackey very often at all. And coming off of a loss, I was saying there's just no way. But, you know, had they beaten UCLA, I probably would have said, okay. I've said throughout the year that I don't think this team is number one. I frankly don't even think they're a one seed, and I've been pretty consistent with that too since pretty much the start of the year. And I thought that this team matches up, or Illinois being the other team, matches up pretty well with Purdue. And I'm kind of mad at myself for not just sticking with my gut and picking Illinois because I would have gotten it right. It would have been 3-1, but instead I go 2-2. Texas Tech, they beat Houston 90-86. Obviously, Houston was due for a loss at some point. Obviously, you know, that fluky loss earlier in the year to Tennessee in the players' era was their only loss of the season, and they had already they kind of escaped danger against Texas Tech at home. And Tech is one of the teams that matches up really well with Houston year in and year out. And they've kind of been the only team. I mean, they were the only team to beat them last year, and it's possible that they're going to be the only team to beat them this year in conference play. Who knows? But speaking of Tennessee, they beat number 17 Alabama 79-73. I got a little bit unlucky with injury luck here. I didn't know the players that would be out for Alabama at the time that I made the picks. Probably still wouldn't have changed it, but maybe would have given me some pause in that game. But Tennessee, good job going on the road and winning at Alabama. That's a hard thing to do. Then you have the NBA, where I went 2-2. The Rockets beat the Pistons 111-104, which I got wrong. The Knicks beat the 76ers 112-109. They were up by a lot in that game and let it get way too close, but I still got it right because they won in the end. Then you have the Cavs who beat the Magic, 119-105. I got that right. And the Warriors who beat the Timberwolves 111-85. Just an absolute drubbing and really surprising considering this was a game or two after Jimmy Butler got injured. So wasn't quite expecting that one, but got that one wrong as well. Got those middle two right. I'm okay with those predictions. And then in tennis, finally, the first tennis predictions of the new year as we head into Grand Slam action, or, well, the first Grand Slam and the only one for a few months until French Open starts in, I think, early June or maybe May, maybe late May. But on the men's side of things, Lerner Tien beat Nuno Borges 7-6, 6-4, 6-2 got that one right. Tommy Paul defeated Alejandro Davidovich Fokina 6-1 to 6-1. Then he retired from that match. Davidovich Fokina did, which unfortunate, but Tommy Paul was well on his way to the victory in the first place. Then Francisco Cerundolo beat Andrei Rublev in three sets, which was surprising. That one was going to be close, but I didn't think three sets was going to happen. I thought, close sets, maybe four, maybe five, if we're lucky. I kind of struggled back and forth on who I would pick, but I definitely didn't think it would be a three-setter either way. And then number six, Alex De Minaur defeated Francis Tiafoe 6-3, 6-4, 7-5. So a good tournament for Alex. We'll get to what happened to him later on in a second. But on the women's side of things, it was Mboko who defeated Clara Tauson in three sets. That was a big win for the young Canadian. Yulia Putintseva beat Sanmez from Turkey 6-3, 6-7, 6-3. So close match there. And then the young American Iva Jovic, who's just, I think, 18 years old, but already seeded 29th, beat number seven Jasmine Paolini 6-2, 7-6. I got that one wrong. That was the only prediction I got wrong. And the number 12, Alina Svitolina, beat Diana Schneider in two sets, 7-6, 6-3. She's been a wrecking crew through this tournament, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. But overall, pretty satisfied with my week. I guess I didn't do the overall record in the first place, but 12-6 overall, 3-1 in both on both sides of tennis, 2-2 in the NBA, 2-2 in college basketball, 2-0 in the NFL, which means that overall, 14-75 and 9-28 is the overall record after a 12-6 week. And that winning percentage up to 61.4%. So I've brought that up a little bit over the past few weeks. So very happy with that. But that's a little bit too much predictions talk. So we'll move on now to the NFL. Of course, there were only two games over the weekend. It was the NFC Championship game and the AFC Championship game. Two very close ones decided by a combined 7 points, but of course, very, very, very different fashions that the games got to their final scores. Of course, the Patriots will take on the Seahawks in the Super Bowl, and we'll have a better Super Bowl preview next week. We're going to save that, obviously, since it's still multiple days out. But the Patriots won 10-7 against the Broncos. A lot of fourth down decisions were kind of the headliners in this game. The Patriots didn't go for it on fourth and goal from the 3 or the 4 yard line, and they kicked a field goal. That field goal was good, and that was the game winner in the game. Whereas the Broncos went for it up 7-0 towards the beginning part of the game. They were up 7-0 at the end of the first, but they went for it somewhere in that span, and they didn't get it. On 4th and 1 on the Patriots 20. And of course, had they had 10 points, well, you can do the math. This game would have been a little different, especially because the weather really started to affect this one in the second half. So interesting decision making back and forth there. But the Broncos calling timeout, going for it, went for a play action pass. It didn't work. The thing that really killed them in this game, though, was Jarrett Stidham's fumble that gave the Patriots the ball on the 20-ish yard line, I think maybe the 19 or something like that, and then the Patriots immediately went down and scored a touchdown. That was the only touchdown drive of the game for them. So they did not sustain any drives throughout the game. The Broncos defense held up amazing in this game, but the issue was that one turnover proved costly. It gave the Patriots their touchdown, and then they just needed to settle for that field goal on a super, super long drive to open the third quarter. Where they had the win behind them. They pulled off a flea flicker in that drive. They did a lot in that drive. But that ended up working out for the Patriots. They played it safe, kicked the field goal, and then the Broncos could not get their field goals to go late in the game because the wind was terrible and they were playing in a blizzard at that point. So really interesting game, but the Patriots, of course, advanced against a banged up Broncos team that puts them in the Super Bowl against the Seahawks because the Seahawks beat the Rams 31-27. They jumped out early in this game to a big lead, spurred mainly by the Rams going three and out on their first possession. That was kind of the only time in this game where you felt like you weren't going to get offense. But the Rams, three and out on their first possession. Seahawks went 7 plays, 81 yards down the field. Rams countered with the field goal. Seahawks got one of their own. Rams got another field goal. The Rams finally took the lead. They had scored 10 unanswered after going down 10-3 because they forced a three and out from Seattle, in between their own field goal and their first touch or their second touchdown drive of the game, or no, their first touchdown drive of the game. Sorry, but then The kind of swing point in this game was that the Rams were up by three before the end of the first half. They called timeout to get the ball back from Seattle, and then they just went run incompletion incompletion, punted it back to Seattle with 54 seconds left, and Seattle went down the field and scored a touchdown in 34 seconds. And that, of course, meant that the Seahawks had a 17-13 lead going into the half. And they got the ball coming out of the half, which we'll get to in a second. But that obviously was a huge momentum swing in this game. And then, of course, the Seahawks punted, so the Rams defense did their job, got off the field. But the inevitable mistake from the special teams for the Rams comes at the worst time possible. And Xavier Smith can't recover the fumble. He muffs it, falling backwards. Seahawks score on the very next play, and all of a sudden, an 11-point lead was just a little bit too much for the Rams to overcome. They had their chances, don't get me wrong. Both teams traded touchdowns. The Rams only entered the fourth quarter down 31-27, which of course was the final score of the game. They forced the Seahawks to punt, and then they went 84 yards down the field, but had to go for it on fourth and four, fourth and four from the 6 yard line. After they had it was second and four, they got a no gain run and then two incompletions on third and fourth down. Seattle ran out the clock from there, and then the Rams got it with 25 seconds left and didn't have enough time to actually get anything done. They did get the ball to midfield, but the issue there was that Puka Nacua didn't get out of bounds on that play, just barely, by the way. And then no Hail Mary attempt from the Rams. So a lot of close decisions, and in the end, it's the Rams special teams mistake that really cost them. Obviously, the Seahawks had the Tariq Woolen taunting penalty. I was looking for the right word there. Taunting penalty that cost them a touchdown, because on the very next play after they got off the field and it would have been fourth down and the Rams would have either kicked a long field goal or punted, he got a taunting. It turned into a first automatic first down for the Rams, and after the automatic first down, they scored a touchdown immediately. So really one big mistake both ways that led directly to a touchdown. And in the end, it was the Rams not converting on that fourth and four from the 6 yard line. And then that situation at the end of the first half that I talked about that really cost LA the game. But if you look at everything, I mean, this was an offensive masterclass by both teams. Kenneth Walker, despite only running for 62 yards on 19 carries, he had a much bigger impact on the game than that. I mean, his longest run was 11 yards, but it just felt like every single time he had the ball in his hands, a Ram might touch him 3 yards behind the line of scrimmage, and he still might get 2 or 3 yards. And that was basically the story of the game, just chunking out yards for them. And then on the other side of things, Blake Corum was a nice spark for the Rams. He had 9 carries for 55 yards. And the passing game on both sides, both these two receivers that are elite on both teams, just absolutely dominated this game. Stafford, 22 of 35, 374, and 3 touchdowns. Darnold, 25 of 36, 346, and 3 touchdowns, too. And then the receivers, Jackson Smith and Jigba, 10 receptions, 153 yards, and a touchdown, including, or on 12 targets, and including a 1 yard catch that was just ridiculous. Puka Nacua, 9 receptions, 165 yards, and a touchdown on 14 targets. And then also Devonta Adams had 4 receptions, 89 yards, and a touchdown on 6 targets of his own. Colby Parkinson had 3 catches for 62 yards, and one of them went for 40, but he had a costly drop in this game that ended up coming back to bite the Rams. So a lot of small things both ways. Really just 3 big plays swung this game, and the rest of it was just offenses going at it. It was an amazing game. I think one of the best games of the season. And if it wasn't one of the best or the best, it was probably topped by the last time these two teams played in Seattle, and that overtime game. And I think that's the only other one that you might put above this one. So just a great game. And of course, sets up that Seahawks Patriots Super Bowl that we talked about. But that's all we have for the NFL. It's time now to move on to a recap of the NBA, where the Pistons are still in first in the Eastern Conference. They're 33-11. It's the second best record in all of the NBA. They're 8-2 in their last 10. Not too far behind them are the Celtics, who are 5 games back at 29-17. They are the top of a log jam between second and fifth place. Next team in that log jam are the Raptors, who are 29-19, so even in the win column, 2 behind in the loss column, 6 games back, but they've won 4 in a row. The Knicks are a half game back of the Raptors. They're 27-18. The Cavs are a half game back of the Knicks. They have won 4 in a row. They are at 28-20. And then in the sixth seed, you have the Sixers, who are tied with the Heat for the seventh seed. The Sixers at 24 and 21, the Heat at 25 and 22. Two games behind them in the win column are the Orlando Magic, who have lost four games in a row to tumble into the play-in bracket. And then the Bulls are a half game behind the Magic at an even 23 and 23. And the Hawks are at 23 and 25 after winning three in a row. They're one game back of the Bulls and three ahead of the Bucks for the final spot in the play-in bracket. The Bucks currently sitting at 18 and 26, so not a great season for Milwaukee, but I think we all know why. There's a lot of Giannis injury stuff going on there, and yeah, just a lot of random background noise that's definitely hampered them. But the interesting team that's kind of up here, getting closer to play-in bracket territory, it's the Hornets. They destroyed the Sixers yesterday, and they are 19 and 28 on the season, which isn't great, but they've won three in a row. They're 6-4 in their last 10. And again, they're only 3.5 games out of a play-in bracket spot. So interesting there for Charlotte. And then right behind Charlotte, well, way behind Charlotte at this point, you have the Nets. They are now leading the group at the bottom of the East. Of course, the Hornets have kind of jumped out of that. There's now 12 competitive teams in the East, but the Nets are definitely not one of them. They're 12 and 32. They've lost five in a row, 1-9 in their last 10, which isn't the worst in their last 10 because there's another team down here, but the Pacers, they're 5-5 in their last 10, but they are 11-36 overall. So, you know, that 6-31 start to the season is going to ruin any bit of momentum they built. And then you have the Wizards, who are 10-34. They have lost nine games in a row, 1-9 in their last 10 at the bottom of the East. Moving on to the West, it's the Thunder, surprise, surprise, who are in first place. They are 37-10. 5.5 games back of them are the Spurs and the Nuggets, who are both 31-15 currently. And then 12, excuse me, not 12 games, two games behind them. You have the Rockets at the fourth seed. They are 28-16. All these teams are really similar. They're all 7-3 or 6-4 in their last 10. And then just behind them, the Lakers, 8 games back overall, a half game back of the Rockets. They're 28-17. A game behind them are the Timberwolves. They have the same amount of wins, but two extra losses. So Houston, three ahead of the Timberwolves, one ahead of the Lakers in the loss column. But the Timberwolves at 28-19, excuse me, are holding down that sixth seed. Right behind them are the Suns in the seventh seed at 27-19. So very, 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 very close, just a half game behind. Then you have the Warriors, who are 26-22. They are two games behind the Suns. Trailblazers, who are in ninth, they're 23-24. And the Clippers, who are one game behind the Blazers and 3.5 behind the Warriors at 21-24, they are 8-2 in their last 10, the hottest team arguably in the entire league. And I think I would make that argument and support it. Then the rest of the West, you have the Mavericks, who I guess used to be one of the competitive teams technically because they were in a play-in spot for a while, but now not so much. They're 19-27, which puts them 2.5 games behind the Clippers, although they are 6-4 in their last 10, so not terrible. You have the Grizzlies, who were tied with the Mavericks. They're 18-26, although they've lost three in a row. The Jazz, who were 15-31, they're four games back of those two, 3-7 in their last 10, and then the Kings at 12-35, who have lost five in a row. And the Pelicans at 12-36, who have won two in a row but are 4-6 in their last 10, and of course, not exactly viewed as any bit of a real contender there in the West. But you know, the bottom of the West, not too great, but the middle really starting to heat up, especially with the Clippers. The Suns kind of surged their way up into the top half of the play-in bracket semi recently as well. So, some interesting things going on in the NBA, but of course, the story of the week has to be college basketball. I mean, if anybody watched college basketball this week, they would have been thoroughly entertained, start to finish. I mean, it was just an amazing week of games, and it started last Tuesday. Of course, number 3 Michigan beat Indiana 86-72. Michigan trying to get their swagger back, starting to blow out teams a little bit more than they had. Everything had been, I get, not even a close call, but closer than you'd expect it to. Although, still worth noting that by the end of the week, Michigan had won four straight games by double digits since their first loss of the season. So there's that. But number 9, Iowa State, they destroyed UCF. You want to talk about getting more breathing room in a game. 87-57. Just, yeah, domination there. NC State went on the road. They beat number 18 Clemson 80-76 in overtime. One of the more exciting games of the day. The other one that was really, really exciting that day, too, number 21 Georgia beat Missouri 74-72. And also the nightcap of that day, UCLA beating number four Purdue 69-67. That game was also really exciting. So Georgia, a last second and one. That was the thing that won the game for them. UCLA with a shot by Tyler Bilodeau that won them the game. And then NC State, of course, with the overtime performance. So three really, really close games late on Tuesday night. In between those games, you also had number 12 Texas Tech. They beat Baylor 92-73. Number 20 Arkansas just demolished Vanderbilt 93-68. The Commodores continue their slide just a little bit. And then you have number 19 Kansas, who beat Colorado 75-69. Nebraska then the next day, of course, beat Washington 76-66 to stay undefeated and set up a clash with undefeated Michigan. Or sorry, not undefeated Michigan. Set up a clash as an undefeated team against Michigan on the road. That one later tonight. Very exciting game coming up. But Michigan beat Ohio State 74-62. Heated rivalry game there. And then they also retired Trey Burke's jersey at halftime. So Buckeyes looking to spoil that, talking a little trash before the game as well. Michigan sending that trash talk back and making sure that Trey Burke wasn't honored with a loss to Ohio State, because that wouldn't be much of an honor at all. But especially for a kid that was from Columbus and went to Michigan, of course, famously. But then you have number 24, St. Louis. They beat St. Bonaventure's 97-62. Just demolition from the Billikens. Nebraska again won again on Saturday morning. They beat Minnesota 76-57. Duke beat Wake Forest 90-69. Another demolition by Duke. Michigan State beat Maryland 91-48. There were some lopsided scores on Saturday. That's all I'm going to say. But the close ones were great, though, which included number 22 North Carolina against number 14 Virginia, and UNC coming out on top in that one, 85-80. Vanderbilt beat Mississippi State 88-56 in really what just turned into a get right game after obviously a rough week for them, with that loss to Arkansas and losses for really the last few weeks. They had started undefeated and then lost three in a row. So it's very important that they get back on the board. They did just that this week or this weekend. We'll see what they can do this week. But number two, UConn, they went to overtime at home, but they did beat Villanova 75-67. Villanova proving maybe they do belong. With that with the top end of the Big East between them, St. John's and UConn. Maybe if they get them at home again, I actually don't know if they do or not, but if they do, watch out. That could be UConn's maybe one and only loss of the conference season. Not many other teams in the conference that look capable of challenging them. Seton Hall was one of them, and they also barely kind of eked by in that game too. So I guess not many teams that can challenge UConn, but those would be some of them. But you also have Texas. They beat number 21 Georgia 87-67. Talked about that one on predictions a little bit. Number one Arizona beat West Virginia 88-53. Again, talking about demolition crews in college basketball. Arizona might have the finest one of them all. Probably do at this point. I mean, I don't think there's any debating that at this point, and we'll talk about why in a second. But Texas Tech beat Houston 90-86, a good win for the Red Raiders, of course. They now split the season series with Houston. And then you have number 11 Illinois, who beat number 4 Purdue 88-82. Talked about that one in predictions as well. Keaton Wagler, 46 points in that game. So you want to talk about the great freshman class? There were 340 pieces on Saturday alone by freshmen playing for ranked teams in big, big games, all of them. So, and none of them were even Kambuser. Well, I will say in terms of big games, AJ DeBonta against Utah, that was not a big game. But BYU did still dominate that game, and he did have 40 points in that game. So it's worth talking about. Of course, Kingston Fleming's also had, I think, 44 or 42 in his game. And of course, Houston still lost to Texas Tech. So pretty crazy there. But then moving on to some other action after the Wagler Masterclass there in Mackey Arena. Number nine, Iowa State beat Oklahoma State 84-71. They continue to blitz through the season. Auburn beat number 16, Florida 76-67. So Auburn going on the road and getting that win. They really needed that because they had a lot of close losses this year and then two blowouts at the hands of Purdue and Michigan. But they hadn't really been able to scrap out a big win in their favor. We can tell that this is a team that's competitive with tournament teams, but the reality is Most of the time, now North Carolina last year is an exception, but most of the time, if you can't get a win against a team in the field, you don't make it into the tournament. So Auburn needed a win like this. I mean, I think they might have another win or two against teams that could make the tournament too, regardless, but I think this was a really, really big one to get on the board. They needed a signature victory, and I think this fits that checks that box off. I mean, it's a road win against Florida, who will end up pretty high up at the conference standings. And also in the country too. This might be a win over a 4 seed or a 3 seed by the end of the year. Then you have number 8 Gonzaga, a little bit banged up, but they still managed to beat San Francisco 68-66, a lot closer than people expected, even with kind of the injury issues for the Bulldogs. But number 19 Kansas went on the road, beat Kansas State. They also didn't have Darren Peterson in that game, so they're a little bit banged up there too, and still win that rivalry. 86-62, of course, the score. The days of Jerome Tang, keeping these games close, pulling out miracle victories when you least expect it. It seems like those are rapidly coming to an end, although we'll see. You never know how good they could be next year, but right now, this team has kind of had the wheels fall off of it. Then you had Tennessee, who beat number 17 Alabama. A banged up Alabama, but an Alabama that got a G League player onto its roster, so that tends to help. But apparently not enough. Tennessee still beat them by 6 on the road. And then in Sunday action, USC beat Wisconsin 73-71. Really important game for USC because if you want to talk about teams that were lacking wins over tournament teams like Auburn, USC was definitely one of them. Frankly, they were on the bubble heading into the weekend and maybe on the wrong side of it entirely. But this win is one of those wins that they went on the road, they beat a team that was not necessarily high up, but probably at least a single digit seed out of 9 seed, maybe an eight low 8 seed, at worst a high end 10 seed. They go in on the road, beat the Badgers in the Kohl Center. USC will have to finish off that road trip against Iowa, which is another team that's floating in that 8 seed, 7 seed, 9 seed range. So it would be nice to get back-to-back wins, although they're not going to need it come tournament time. But that was a big win for USC to get on the board. And of course, for Wisconsin, takes them from that elevated position they got to by beating Michigan and continuing that strong stretch of play for a week or so. And it puts them not squarely on the bubble, but a lot closer to it than you'd want to be. I guess as a fan, it's never good to be on the bubble. It's just not the way you want to live, and not the way you want your season to turn out, because then it's really stressful on Selection Sunday. But then you have number 4 Duke. They will not have a stressful Selection Sunday. You can write them in Sharpie to your bracket right now, because there's no way this team. It's probably going to end up anything but a 1 seed, frankly, but they beat number 20 Louisville 83-52. Just domination. I mean, this was the game that Louisville got Mykel Brown Jr. back in, and people thought that their last game got away from Louisville, but it was close at times, and people thought, okay, it was close-ish at home. Maybe they can swing some magic on the road with Mykel Brown back, and Duke just said no. This game was a 10-point game at the half, and then they blew it wide open in the second half. So Duke, just a really great performance. And then Arizona, they kind of had the opposite of that. That game was they were up by 13 at the half, and then brought it to a big margin. And then all of a sudden, BYU started climbing back in. I've talked about it though before, maybe not too much on this podcast, but definitely in general. BYU starts so slow that against good teams, it's really hard to win games. I think. It took them the buzzer beater and the miraculous comeback against Clemson earlier in the year. But against a team like Arizona, everything went right for them down the stretch. They got a flagrant from Arizona. They got foul calls. They got everything that you could get. And they still ended up losing because Arizona had the better clutch play, Braden Burry's block really winning that game for the Wildcats. But the fact of the matter is, you can't just go down by 15 at the half every single time you play. It's a huge issue, and it's one of the reasons why they're going to lose many games this year. They need to figure out a way to start better, and they did, frankly, against Texas Tech. They were actually leading that game up until the end of it, although I guess it was closer in the first half, and then they took the lead late and then gave it up, and Texas Tech won. But they have to find a way to just start a little bit better. They're very clearly a second half team, and that might not change. That's fine. They can make adjustments in the second half and be a better second half team than they are a first half team, but they just can't be pedestrian in the first half. And it feels like that's what the story has been all season long for the Cougars, and they could get a little bit better there. Although, of course, that's nitpicky. They barely lost any games this season. So, just grasping at anything to say of what BYU could fix going forward. But It's a tough top of the Big 12, and if you're going to start slow in games against Kansas, Iowa State, Arizona, Houston, Texas Tech, you're not going to win many games. Those teams are going to come out, they're going to blitz you, they're going to be on top of you by 15, 20 points, just like Arizona was in this one at the half, if you don't start well. So something that BYU needs to fix going forward, but they're still a great team. Definitely one of the upper echelon teams in the country. Easy second weekend contender. But to end the podcast, let's take a look at the Australian Open, where we'll start with some quarterfinals action. On the women's side, it's Aryna Sabalenka who beat Iva Jovic yesterday, 6-3, 6-0. Or I guess yesterday is an interesting concept when you're talking about Australia, because I guess this might have been this morning in Eastern time, Central time, whatever time zone you're in. So it happened. The game happened last night at some point. But Sabalenka won. Really easy match for her. Jovic just a little bit too young, too inexperienced to pull out that one, but a great tournament run for her nonetheless. Coco Gauff, meanwhile, obviously has the experience at majors and just in general, but Elina Svitolina, obviously more experienced, definitely, one of the seasoned vets on tour, but she just dominated Coco in this match, 6-1, 6-2. Not much Coco Gauff could do. It was one of the matches where, the serve confidence kind of spiraled on her a little bit, not as bad as it's been in the past, but she also couldn't get her return game going off of Svitolina, obviously, as evidenced by the fact that she only won three total games. So credit to Svitolina just playing her heart out in that game. And then two quarterfinals left over, Jessica Pegula against Amanda Anisimova. So the last American standing will come from those games, as or that match as the first. Two matches had an American eliminated in each, and then Elena Rybakina, excuse me, against Iga Świątek for the semifinals as well. Of course, the winners of those two will play each other in the semis, and then the final will be between the winner of those two matches against each other and then the winner of Sabalenka and Svitolina. So looking like it's going to be Sabalenka and probably Świątek, but I wouldn't be too surprised if Anisimova made it through. I wouldn't be surprised really if any of these players made it through. After all, these are seeds 2, 4, 5, and 6. So not much separating them, other than the fact that Arena stands above the rest currently. But then on the men's side of things, you had the quarterfinals. This has been a very chalky Australian Open in general. But number three, Zverev, beat number 25, Lerner Tien. He had a great run at this tournament. Zverev had some struggles in this match, but in the end, he won in four sets, 6-3. 6-7, 6-1, 7-6. So Tien did get one set off of him. It was a good performance by Lerner, honestly, throughout the tournament. Obviously, if you look at the seeds here, it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 8, and then number 25. So the only player who wasn't supposed to be here, quote unquote, and was still alive. So a great showing by him throughout the tournament, but of course, not able to finish it off with that win against Zverev to get to the semis. Still, again, really young player, really showing his upside. He's a crafty lefty who's very, very good at shaping his shots, and he showed that a lot in this match, although Zverev just a little bit too powerful, a little bit too experienced to beat. But then you have Alcaraz. He beat Demonauer in three sets, 7-5, 6-2, 6-1. You'd think that this would be closer, but I mean, this is what happens with Alcaraz, right? If you're not a dominant server, his return game, his defense, and his power tends to just outdo you as the match goes on. And I think that, Alex is a great player, but this is not the matchup for him to be in because he's a little too similar, stylistically, in terms of not relying on his serve. That's kind of the only player that can beat Alcaraz is either someone of the level of Sinner or Djokovic who have that same level of finesse, same level of defense, and can get on you in attack and also have the mental fortitude to stay in it, or just a big server who can also go out there and just out-hit him and get enough free points that Alcaraz's few mistakes when he gets aggressive are the things that end up ending his matches. But Demonor does not fit that billing at all. And, he played this one close in the first set especially, got a few huge points in there at home, but not able to break the seal of the quarterfinals there. The other quarterfinals will be Ben Shelton against Jannik Sinner. Obviously, Shelton looking for one of those signature victories against one of the big three. We'll see if he can get it done. But Sinner also in pretty good form right now. Really had the one match where he struggled a little bit with his injuries against Spizzeri, but that's about it. So I kind of expect him to not necessarily mow through this game. Obviously, Shelton, again, one of those big servers that can kind of just take free points, free games off of these really dominant players, but still don't necessarily think that he'll end up with the win, although I obviously am pulling for him as an American representative, but Sinner, probably going to win that one. And then you have Lorenzo Musetti against Djokovic, the 4 and the 5 seeds there. Well, I guess flipped, Musetti being the 5 and Djokovic being the 4. But that will be an interesting match as well. I actually don't really have much of a lean there because Djokovic has had some time off because his last match was a walkover against Jakub Benčík. So it'll be interesting to see how he comes out. Obviously, Djokovic, when he's rested and hasn't been fatigued throughout the tournament, is a different player than when he's had to grind through it all, especially at this age, at this point. So I favor him pretty, I mean, not heavily, but I wouldn't say it's just a lean. I feel good about him winning, just because of that rest factor. But on the other hand, Musetti coming off the win against Fritz, he has a lot of confidence in this one. And he's also been playing some great tennis for a long time running now. So obviously evidenced by the fact that he's the 5 seed, but both of those two really, really interesting matches. And of course, Alcaraz and Zverev in the semifinals. That's an Austra not Australian Open, a French Open from 2 years ago. That was the final that Alcaraz, of course, broke through in. But we'll see. That one always entertaining. Those two. You know, Zverev is that type of player that I was talking about, who's big enough to get those free points on serve, and also good enough, skilled enough, technical enough to get other points. Get points on Alcaraz's serve himself. So really interesting matchup there. And then of course that final, that other semifinal, whether it's Shelton Djokovic, Shelton Musetti, if it's Sinner Musetti, Sinner Djokovic, I don't care what the matchup is, it will be exciting either way. And I think it will be Alcaraz coming out from that matchup between him and Zverev. So looking forward to seeing any of those four against Alcaraz and seeing if anybody can beat him at his own game on the hard court. But we will talk about all that action on the next episode of the podcast. Of course, that wraps up this edition of the 4th and 24 podcast. So please be sure to check out next week's podcast on February 3rd. Can't believe it's February. That means, of course, 1 month from March, everyone's favorite month, where we will once again talk about my weekend predictions. We will preview the Super Bowl, have our weekly review of the NBA and college basketball action, and of course, recap the end of the Australian Open. But in the meantime, be sure to check out my picks for next weekend's games, which will be posted as always on Thursday, and my college basketball bracketology, which comes out every Monday, and potentially might start being 2 times a week in the very near future. I normally do that in February, but still debating on whether I want to do that or not, but probably. And all of that, of course, is on our social media handles at 4th of 24. That's the number 4, THAND, plus the number 24. Thank you for listening.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
Why choose a Sleep Number smart bed?
Can I make my site softer?
Can I make my site firmer?
Can we sleep cooler?
Sleep Number does that. Cools up to 8 times faster and lets you choose your ideal comfort on either side. Your Sleep Number setting. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number 1 in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store and online. And now, the more you buy, the more you save on beds, bases, and more. Plus, get free home delivery on most beds with Base. Limited time. For J.D. Power 2025 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Check it out at a Sleep Number store today.